You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this, the fifth day of 2018, the first podcast of 2018 for the Indians, and today pinch hitting for Jordan Bastian, our good friend Anthony Castrovince. Castro, we thank you as always for the time, and what we're doing today is simply taking a look ahead to this very promising and talented and deep Indian squad for 2018, answering the five biggest questions that the tribe faces as they look to reach the promised land here in 2018. So, Anthony, want to start here. You look at this Indians rotation in 2017, and they were just dynamite, led by the Cy Young winner, Corey Kluber. They were good. They were durable. They ate innings. They were very effective. But baseball being the cruel vixen that she is it reasonable to expect at least a little regression from this group in 2018?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on the key word, Matt, which is durable, and it's just hard to count on that from year to year. We see that. And, you know, sometimes the greatest indicator of future injury is past injury. And, you know, Danny Salazar, of course, you know, continued to have struggles with the elbow in 2017. So it remains to be seen how he holds up going forward. And, you know, I think about Corey Kluber's back, of course, was a big topic of conversation early in 2017, and then again at the end of 2017 when he labored in the playoffs. So, it's going to be tough to repeat. I think just the sheer performance alone is tough to repeat. I mean, there, by some measures, this was a historic pitching staff in 2017. So, you know, they might have to rely on the offense a little more. You never know. The one good thing the Indians have going for them going into the year and going into spring training is just pure depth. And, you know, like Ryan Merritt is an example of a guy out of options who doesn't really have an obvious role on the staff right now. You know, should things crop up in spring training, which tends to happen, you know, when guys report and start, you know, throwing pitches in earnest, you know, sometimes they come up with some things. And so that depth is important to have going into the year.
Yeah, you take a look at the Cubs in 2016, the year they won the World Series. Obviously, that rotation was historically good, and you just can't expect to duplicate that again. And that's you know, what happened to the Cubs in 2017. They were still good, but not historically good as they were in 2016. The Indians hoping to avoid that same fate here in 2018. Anthony, Terry Francona on more than one occasion has just heaped praise upon praise upon praise for Brian Shaw and the work he did out of that bullpen for a number of years. You know, Cody Allen and Andrew Miller, they're kind of the marquee guys of that pen, and they get the lion's share of the attention, and deservedly so. But Francona, again, he just said Brian Shaw was such an unsung hero of that bullpen. He, of course, has moved on. How tough is it going to be to replace him?
You know, very tough. I don't think they will replace him just in terms of his durability and you know, just the ability to take the ball for so many innings in a given year. And year after year, in his case, pretty much a freak of nature when it comes to that. So, but as far as the performance goes, you know, other guys just have to step up, and they step into more prominent roles. I mean, Dan Otero and Nick Goody in-house, you know, those are two guys who you're going to see in more high-leverage spots than we did last season. So it's the combined effect of losing Shaw and Joe Smith, who's an important trade pickup for them mid-season. You know, they just invited a bunch of guys from their system to spring training camp, and, you know, there could be more exposure for those guys here moving forward over the course of 2017, because, of course, bullpens are always a moving target and a lot of guys filter in and out. But yeah, as far as identifying those trusted options, you know, Otero, Goody, McAllister, you know, these are guys who Terry Francona is going to have to determine if he can trust them in the big moments as the year goes along, because we've seen it so often, Matt, the evolution in this game, we've seen in recent years that it's not about having an elite closer. It's not even about having an elite closer paired with an elite setup man. It's about having four, five, six guys that you can count on night after night after night, because starters just don't go as deep into the games as they traditionally did, even in a great rotation like the Indians have. So I'm also curious to see just, you know, the remainder of this winter. If they're obviously, they have a limited budget here, you know, these last 6 weeks or so before spring training, but there's still a lot of bullpen arms out there, not the high, you know, profile guys who really flew off the shelves early in the winter, but still a lot of options out there. And for a team that's been really good about identifying, you know, kind of bargain buys in that department, you know, this is their chance to shine, because they're going to need them.
Yeah, no question. And like you said, it's going to take more than just one guy to replace Bryant Shaw. It's going to be, you know, two or three guys to kind of fill that role and be complementary pieces to the light, the guys that we know are going to be lights out, and Andrew Miller, Cody Allen, and even throw Dan Otero into that mix, as he's been very good for the Indians the past couple years. Anthony, Michael Brantley has always been kind of a fascinating topic to discuss, a guy that as recently as a couple years ago, a top three finisher in a MVP voting. I almost said Cy Young. Maybe he can pitch too. I don't know. But a top three finisher in the MVP vote. Of course, he's been hampered by injuries in the past year or two. How concerning right now are the health issues of Michael Brantley? Can we have full confidence that he's going to be healthy and be the Michael Brantley we know he can be?
Well, first of all, after two shoulder surgeries in the recent past, I don't think we'll see him on the mound anytime soon. But and now, of course, coming off the ankle injury. And look, I understand why the Indians picked up that option, you know, relative to the marketplace. I think in the open market, Michael Brantley would have commanded that and probably a multi-year deal from some other club. And they value him so much, his presence in that clubhouse and in that lineup. And we saw, you know, in 2017, when healthy, he was an all-star. He was a legitimately great comeback story in the first half of the year. And then the ankle injury, of course, occurred in August, and that was pretty much that. He was a non-factor in the postseason. So I understand the fan frustration with spending that amount of money. Again, if you have a limited budget in the winter, allocating that amount of money to a guy who is coming off so many injuries in the recent past, I get the concern or consternation there on the part of the fans. I also get it on the part of the Indians of, you know, why they felt that was necessary to do. Ultimately, you know, I mean, this is such an obvious answer, but yeah, he has to stay healthy, I mean, fundamentally. So, you know, they signed John Dorlanzo to play first base, so that kind of crushes the idea of perhaps Brantley, you know, moving to first, even on a limited basis, you know, to kind of help preserve that body a bit. And whether that would have even been the case, who knows? But I don't count on him being in there on opening day. I think they're, you know, approaching it realistically. I mean, they hope in the latter part of April he'll be a factor for them. So, yeah, he's going to be a key X factor again this year. I feel like we've been saying this every winter, and we have the last three winters now, where identifying Michael Brantley as a huge X factor for the Indians, and it's once again true.
Yeah, well, he's nothing if not consistent, right? That is, again, a topic for Brantley coming into 2018, and we'll see what happens there. Anthony, a few more to wrap up. Jose Ramirez, if not for transcendent years by Aaron Judge and Jose Altuve, he would have been the AL MVP. He was that good in 2017, a top three finisher. But there's some uncertainty as to whether he's a second baseman, a third baseman. If he's a second baseman, what does that mean for Jason Kipnis? Does he go to the outfield? If that happens, who does that displace right there? Whole bunch of dominoes could fall. How do you think Terry Francona is going to sort this whole thing out?
Well, first of all, the Brantley situation that we just discussed, you know, the possibility that he's not exactly ready for, you know, the start of the regular season. I could foresee Jason Kipnis out there in left field at the start of the season, at least, and then kind of figure it out from there. But, you know, their first preference is for Jose Ramirez to be at second base. I think we saw it with Kipnis on the shelf in the latter part of the year, and they go on that 22-game winning streak. You know, Ramirez is the second baseman, Lindor at short. It was a really special combination up the middle. They were just better defensively. And, of course, what Ramirez brings you at the plate, no matter where he's playing, is if it's anything like it was in 2017, it's valuable. So, you know, that's their best defensive alignment. They did try to trade Kipnis. It's no secret this winter. You know, him making $13 million, that would have been, you know, money they could free up to do other things. And maybe that still happens, but it obviously hasn't happened to date. So, so ultimately, you know, when Brantley is healthy, I could see Kipnis floating back and forth between positions, you know, second base and in the outfield, depending on what the daily concoction is in that lineup. But and that could mean Ramirez going back and forth between second and third, which, you know, it's not ideal. You want him plugged into one position on an everyday basis, but he's also shown the aptitude, the ability to do it. So you might want to kind of take advantage of that. But, yeah, a lot of moving parts. I mean, Yandy Diaz over at third base. Giovanni Urshela is going to be out of options, so he'll be interesting in spring training what happens there. But, you know, Yandy Diaz might have the biggest pure upside for them, you know, in the early part of the year. And he could be in the corner outfield. He could be at third base. The other X factor here is Francisco Mejia, the number one prospect. And, you know, he's seen some time at third base in the latter part of the minor league season and the Arizona Fall League. So I would not be shocked if he's a contributor at the big league level in the first half of the year and potentially at the hot corner.
Yeah, a lot of pieces to sort through for Terry Francona. It's, as the saying goes, a good problem to have, but there's still a lot of sorting out to do to figure out what is the best alignment for all concerned for the 2018 season. Anthony, one more to wrap up. Of course, the Indians have been among baseball's elite teams the past couple seasons, coming oh so close to winning it all in 2016, and then, of course, the heartbreaking ALDS defeat at the hands of the Yankees this past year. How much longer do you think this this window is going to be open for the Indians to not just be a good team, but a legit World Series contender?
Well, they have controllable assets in their starting rotation, which in many cases is half the battle. But I think the Mets are a good example of how quickly the window maybe doesn't shut, but it certainly changes if health invades that starting rotation. So that's the danger there. The other danger for the Indians, of course, is that as much as they've relied on the starting rotation, they've also been probably equally reliant on the back end of that bullpen with Cody Allen and Andrew Miller, and both those guys are entering their walk years. And we've seen the price of bullpen help has dramatically escalated in this game where, you know, Brian Shaw just got a contract that in terms of average annual value was the same as Andrew Miller's contract. So it just goes to show where that's headed, where that market is headed. And, so the odds of the Indians bringing back one or both of those guys is perhaps slim. So that's going to be a fascinating dynamic a year from now, and that just kind of speaks to the importance of maximizing this situation right now. The division will get better. You know, the White Sox are building something potentially special on the south side. The Twins are coming. We saw that last year where they snuck into the wild card game, and they have, you know, some really nice young pieces in that lineup. So I really love the Indians' projection for 2018. I think they are in a good position to potentially even dominate the division again. Certainly they're in a good position to be the clear favorite, you know, going into the year. But, you know, are we going to be able to say that going into 2019, 2020? I'm not as sure, just because of those dynamics that I just mentioned. So it's all about this moment, Matt. And there was that's what made the division series, you know, exit in 2017 so frustrating. It was obviously a legitimately great team, one of the best teams in Major League Baseball by any measure. And you had the momentum of that 22-game streak and all that stuff, and they didn't take advantage of it. So they clearly got to capitalize on 2018.
Yeah, maybe you don't go quite as far to say 2018 is make or break, but it's darn close, and I know that the Indians know that, and they want to do something special here in 2018 because from year to year, things are never the same. A lot of uncertainty, and we'll see if that sense of urgency produces a few more W's in October for this very talented Indians team. Anthony Castrovin's great stuff as always. We appreciate the time, and we will chat again soon. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians. The first White Sox podcast of 2018. Happy New Year to all the Pale Hills fans and to you, Mr. Scott Merkin, our White Sox reporter for MLB.com. Scott, as always, we thank you for the time. What we're doing today to kick off the new year is looking at two or three of the biggest questions that the White Sox face heading into the 2018 season. So, Scott, I want to start here with this White Sox team that is clearly rebuilding. They've got a ton of great, talented assets in the farm system. So with that in mind, who would you say are the next Sox, so to speak, to arrive on the big league scene and make an impact?
Well, first of all, Happy New Year to you, too, and all the White Sox fans out there and everyone else for that matter, too. But, you know, I would – it's interesting because, you know, I've been doing inboxes, you know, where you answer fans' questions pretty regularly during the offseason, have another one that's going up soon. And one question that gets – was a combo question that gets literally asked every time I ask for questions is, when will Michael Kopech arrive in the majors and when will Eloy Jimenez arrive in the majors?
Right.
And I would think those are the next two big names in line. Now, again, there are some guys who kind of, you know, that maybe aren't in the top 30 or top 20 radar that surprise. Like, look at the, you know, the nice run Nicky Delmonico had last year and has put himself into a starting position going into, as we sit here right now, going into 2018. But I, you know, Kopech is the main guy. Kopech has got, you know, ace makeup. He looks like he could be a top of the rotation guy for a long time to come. And I think from what I've heard and just from what I'm looking at, I would say he follows kind of a similar path to what Ronaldo Lopez did in the majors last year. So, you know, I'm sure they're going to look at him in spring training. He'll be there in camp, but I don't think he's going to break camp with the team. I think you'll see him, you know, get to the rotation at some point during the year where they can put him through 8, 9, 10, whatever, maybe even 12 starts, get a read on him and then get him going full force into 2019. And Jimenez is a guy who's so talented that he may force their hand. You know, I mean, it's conceivable he could spend the whole year in the minors. That would be fine by the White Sox. He had like 73 plate appearances at Double A Birmingham last year, and that's the highest he's played so far. Now, again, there are many players who jump from, you know, Double A level or even A level to the majors, so you can see him up there. But I think Jimenez would be later in the year, giving him a chance to get a full start at Birmingham and then probably even play a little bit at Charlotte before he comes up. So those are the two names I would keep an eye on, and those are the two names that everyone is keeping an eye on and anxiously crossing days off the calendar until they see them in a Sox uniform, major league uniform.
Yeah, and with good reason for all the things that they did at the minor league level, Kopech and Jimenez both, to see them at the big league level doing their thing, a very exciting prospect for White Sox fans, no question. Of course, Scott, when you look at the rotation right now, it is a rotation that is obviously without Chris Sale, without Jose Quintana. Carlos Rodon has shown flashes. He's never quite put it all together just yet, but he's still very young. Rather inexperienced, but we know the talent's there. He's been hurt, though. What is his timetable, and what do you expect from him when he does return?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One of the questions I was asked going back to the inbox is who will be the Sox opening day starter this year? And, you know, they're a team that kind of waits to tell you anyways in spring training, even when you have a guy that's kind of a slam dunk like Sale or Quintana. I think Rodon would have been that next guy in line, the next anointed opening day starter. But with him out, you know, who knows? It could be Shields. It could be Giolito. You know, it's kind of up in the air. In terms of Rodon, the Sox have been very consistent in that at the year-end press conference, and Rick Hahn talked to the media about the shoulder surgery that Rodon had that ended his season in, you know, late September, said they basically won't really know what they have and what's going forward with him until he gets throwing, Rick likes to use the phrase, in anger, you know, during spring training. So people have asked, I've asked, a lot of reporters have asked, and Rick has said the same thing. You know, I even asked Scott Boras at the winter meetings, Rodon's representative, his agent, and they're basically saying that, you know, he's crossing off all the boxes, you know, dotting all the I's, crossing the T's, moving forward with the rehab, but you won't really know what the timetable is until he gets throwing, you know, February 14th, I think. And I don't even know if he'll be throwing as soon as he gets there. He has been very active on social media during this offseason, which is kind of a change in the past for him, and seems very happy and very upbeat, so things must be going pretty well. And, you know, I would guess, if I had to make a guess right now, he won't be ready at the start of the season. But, you know, the timetable is fluid, as it, you know, could be. They said 6 to 8 months when he had the surgery, so that could mean, you know, as late as June, could be before then. But I would not bet on him starting the season with the White Sox.
And, Scott, to come down the home stretch here, we saw the White Sox involved in a multiplayer three-team trade just one day ago as we speak on this Friday the 5th. The White Sox getting their hands on longtime veteran reliever Joaquin Soria, so he's going to join that White Sox bullpen for 2018. With that in mind, and this is a question I was pretty fascinated by that you posed on WhiteSox.com, for a White Sox team that is in clear rebuilding mode, how does this team now define being opportunistic? It's going to be different from other teams that are clear playoff contenders. So what is the White Sox definition of that term?
Well, I think you look at the trade they made, and, you know, they picked up Luis Avalon, who's a solid left-hander, and they have a couple years of control over him. Soria, they have this year, and there's a mutual option for 2019. So they're adding guys there that, you know, should be competitive in the bullpen, should be competitive late innings in the bullpen, that you have now, you know, can help you this year. You can potentially flip if things, you know, don't, if you're not a contending team, or you can hang on to and maybe use them as you start growing into a contender where they've targeted 2019. But I think the rumors around the Manny Machado pursuit, which the Sox have never confirmed, denied, or acknowledged, really, is the key thing. You know, they made an offer, but they did not make an offer that would change the rebuild in any way. You know, I mean, they were good players, good young players that I, you know, that were offered that I've, you know, heard. But it wasn't like they're not going to give up Michael Kopech or Lucas Giolito or Yoan Moncada. And again, no offense to anyone else on that team, but these are kind of the cornerstones, you know, along with Eloy Jimenez, and you can name a few more. So trying to get Machado in, they want this group to learn how to win. They don't want it just to be cold where you're like, okay, 17 and 18, losing seasons, now let's go win in 19. So adding veterans that could help that is key, but they're not going to do anything that, you know, they've said, sustained success, multiple championships they want to contend for, and that's the, even though they're focusing on, you know, putting together a team for 18, that's their bigger picture focus, is keeping this team strong for years to come.
Yeah, you don't want to be a one-year wonder, a flash in the pan.
Exactly.
You want to build something, sustain it for multiple years. That's always the goal of any franchise in baseball, and the White Sox no different. We'll see how 2018 progresses along that path towards achieving that goal. Scott Merkin, great stuff as always. We appreciate it, and we'll do it again at this time next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Chicago White Sox. It is the first of many Tigers podcasts in the brand new year of 2018. It is Matt Wehmeyer joined by Jason Beck, our Tigers reporter for MLB.com. And Jason, happy new year to you, and we thank you for the time. And we're going to keep it simple today because, as we've talked about in previous weeks, not just with the Tigers but with the other 29 teams in baseball, it has been a rather painfully slow offseason. The hot stove not exactly simmering right now, but what we can do until things kind of heat up in that regard is run down the five biggest questions that the Tigers, this rebuilding Tigers team, faces coming into 2018. So we're going to just kind of run down the list, and I think Jason will start here with some health issues for two of the team's bigger stars. Miguel Cabrera and Jordan Zimmermann, the question you posed recently on Tigers.com was, can they both stay healthy? And given the ages of Miggy and Zimmermann, and given the nature of their injuries and ailments in recent years, what kind of a chance do you put on the fact that, or the proposition rather, that both these guys can have a full, productive, healthy 2018?
Well, I think I give Cabrera a little bit of a better chance than Zimmermann, just because of Zimmermann's had the same issue for back-to-back years now. And it sounds like with the neck issues, he's going to be at least somewhat reliant on some nerve block injections for the foreseeable future, at least from time to time, that it's going to flare up and he's going to have it addressed. That it might not completely go away. Who knows when, if ever. Cabrera at least sounds like the type of thing that, while you could certainly see the back issue becoming a bigger problem as he gets older, it's something that you could see him addressing with a little bit of change in workout techniques and a little bit of a change in physique, at least carrying a little bit less weight around and maybe adjusting to some other things in terms of fitness and how he handles himself. We'll see. It would make a big difference, certainly, if either one can have a full healthy season, but I think given what Cabrera can do when he's healthy, I think it's bigger for Cabrera to be healthy.
Yeah, I certainly agree. You know, given the fact that this Tigers team is in a clear rebuild, you still need that veteran presence, and Miguel Cabrera is certainly that, and then some, to kind of, you know, help out these youngsters and set the tone, set the example, and coming off what is easily the worst season of his career in 2017. There is a hope that if Miggy can get healthy and stay healthy, he can be, if not, you know, prime Miguel Cabrera, a reasonable facsimile of it for 2018, and hopefully a bounce-back campaign is in store for the big fella. Jason, question number two, if Michael Fulmer is healthy, yet another guy that is dealing with health issues, are his days in Detroit numbered? This is something we've talked about in recent weeks, you know, the debate being, well, this is a guy, he's young and controllable, and he's obviously very good. That's a guy you want to build around. The flip side to that argument is, well, this is a guy because of those attributes that you want to deal, because you can turn one guy into maybe four or five. So what's your take on that situation?
I think his days are numbered. It might not be as soon as we might think, but I just think with the long-term scale of the Tigers rebuild, that unless it goes a lot faster than anticipated, that it's going to be a race for them, and a difficult race for them, to get back into contention before he becomes right at that point where he's up for free agency. Now, they could wait it out. I mean, they've certainly capable of doing that, depending on what their commitment from ownership is. But I think given the value of pitchers like Fulmer, and especially pitchers like Fulmer with so many years of control remaining, if he demonstrates that he's back to the form he had in 2016, that the appeal is going to be huge for him for other teams to try to acquire, especially given the prices that many of the free agent pitchers are going for nowadays. You know, aren't really a whole lot of great free agent starting pitchers out there anymore. And I don't think that's going to change because I think guys are going to be locking up with teams for longer term deals. And the Tigers, maybe the Tigers end up doing that and surprise us all, but I think given the market, given how far the Tigers have to go, and given the need that the Tigers have to get another package of prospects to make this rebuild work, Fulmer is the most likely ticket for them to get that. And it's hard for them. It's hard to see this working without that type of deal. And he's the most likely candidate.
Yeah, Jason, I know that these types of things are very hard to project and predict, you know, with guys that are so young and hopefully have long careers ahead of them. But from what you've seen from Michael Fulmer, what kind of a ceiling do you see for him as he matures, as he gets into his prime athletic years? Do you see, I don't know, a Justin Verlander-type ceiling? I know that's a very high bar, but, you know, do you see something approaching that? Or what's your kind of prediction for him?
I don't see him quite at that level as far as ceiling goes. I don't think he has a repertoire that Verlander does, but I think he's a bona fide ace, certainly with his ceiling. He's an ace caliber pitcher right now, and I think he's only going to get better as long as he's healthy. Maybe approaching the level of a Verlander or a Scherzer, not quite there, but the type of guy that you can build a rotation around. And I think the type of guy that can go to a contending team and make a very big impact.
Yeah, he's going to be one of the more highly coveted pitchers that teams want to acquire if indeed he is put out there on the market, and it speaks to the nature of the beast, so to speak, and in terms of the trade market and teams that are going for it. The fact that if the Tigers do deal him, he'd be with his third organization in the very, infancy of his career for a guy so talented. But again, that just speaks to the nature of the beast, so to speak. Jason, question three regarding Victor Martinez, a guy that, again, and this is a recurring theme, dealing with health issues. He's not a young man anymore by athletic standards. He's, 39 years old now. But when healthy, he is as good with the bat as anybody in the game. But it might be kind of a mismatch or a bad fit right now for a team that's in a clear rebuilding mode. What do you see for a future for V-Mart with the Tigers?
Well, I wrote a little bit more on that this week. And by every indication from everything that General Manager Abel has said, they're going to bring him in the camp and let him try to show that he can still hit and show that he still has a place on this team. The one thing working in his favor is that this team doesn't have a whole lot of hitters who are on the cusp of being major league ready right now. I think aside from the guys you saw in September, there aren't very many guys, if any guys, who can go in the spring training and steal a job in the starting lineup right now, unless somebody like Kristen Stewart goes out and has just some bonkers training camp or Mike Gerber or somebody like that. And even then, I would be surprised because neither of those guys has spent much time at all at AAA. And I think the Tigers want those guys to get to AAA and get some learning done there as hitters before they unleash them in Detroit. So if you assume that, then it's not like you're weighing Victor Martinez against a guy on the brink of being ready to hit the majors. So, you're not holding anybody out of a job. You're not hindering anybody's development by bringing in Victor Martinez and letting him hold down a job for a little while longer if he's healthy. You're not even risking anything financially because he's already committed for this coming season, $18 million. That's going to be spent whether he makes a team or not, unless they come to some sort of surprise settlement with him, if there's like a health issue or something. So, given that, there's really no glaring reason to hold him out of camp and shut him down and say, you know, you're done here. And because he might not be done. Who knows? I'm going to be curious to see what he looks like in camp because he's older and because of the heart issues and because of the concerns, somebody like that, because of the family history, you know, somebody who lost his father at a young age because of a heart attack. You wonder what's going through Victor's mind as he gets ready for all this. But by all indications, he wants to compete. He wants to have a role on his team, and he wants to try to have some sort of positive impact on this rebuilding club.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there's very little risk in you know, bringing him, not to bring him aboard, he's already aboard, obviously, but to let him prove himself and to get back to the player that he is capable of being. But again, as you've said, he's got things on his mind much bigger than baseball, given the health issues that he's gone through, given his family history with those health issues. So a lot on V-Mart's mind heading into the 2018 season for sure. Jason, you mentioned, too, that a lot of the younger guys on this team not quite major league ready at the play, but one guy that certainly is and has demonstrated that time and again is Nicklas Castellanos. And I know that Tigers fans are kind of looking at him, you know, if not the next Miguel Cabrera, because that's again, a very high bar, at least a guy that can anchor a lineup that you can slot in there as a 3-4 guy and a guy that can maybe carry an offense with the right pieces around him. Is that a reasonable expectation for Castellanos? Can Tigers fans kind of pin their hopes on this guy, you know, becoming that kind of player down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think he can be a key cog in the lineup nowadays. Assuming that while Cabrera has a chance to still be an elite hitter, he's going to need somebody batting behind him. All indications are that Nick lines up as that guy. You look at the hard hit rate that he had last year, and you look at how many hard hit outs he has, there's a lot of upside, I think, to his game. And I think he's somebody that, if he can get the ball in the air a little bit more often, that the ball could travel a little bit more, he's got a chance to be a big-time home run guy and also get a nice boost on average, even beyond the jump that he had last year. So if he can do even part of that, I think he's, you know, potential all-star hitter. And I think if he can put all of that together, you know, you're looking at maybe not another Cabrera, but maybe a hitter on along the lines of Justin Upton or JD Martinez.
And those are certainly guys that you would love to emulate. No slouches they. Castellanos has shown plenty of flashes in the past couple of years, and Tigers fans hoping that maybe 2018 is the true breakout and that he really arrives on the scene this season and beyond. And Jason, to wrap things up, I know that Tigers fans are you know, hoping and awaiting that next big batch of prospects because, again, with the team in clear rebuilding mode, this is where, you know, you're going to butter your bread and make your money with the guys coming up through the farm system. If not 2018, what is a reasonable, time of expectation for these guys to come up and start contributing at the major league level?
I think we can start seeing guys, you know, if not September of 2018, then more likely some point during 2019, especially the pitchers. I think you're going to be patient with these arms, including the guys who ended last year, Double A, Bo Burrows and Franklin Perez, that they're going to try to be careful with these guys, but both of those guys have the talent to start knocking on the door either at the end of this season or at some point next season, maybe even competing for a job in spring training of 2019. You know, let them come in and get their feet wet and start the learning process of how to approach major league hitters if they do well enough at AAA. I think they're going to want those guys to get, you know, at least a year of AAA under their belts and learn some lessons there with more experienced older hitters compared to some of the other minor league levels before taking a shot. And they might not even open the season. I think it's more likely to put those guys open the season in Erie and then maybe make the jump later on to AAA. But I think that's when you can start to see the process. And a guy like Alex Fajardo, it's going to be interesting to see how he progresses, because he's somebody who is so advanced in college, but yet still has a lot to learn, because he got so much done with basically a two-pitch arsenal at Florida, that he's going to have some learning to do as far as he has that third pitch, but now he's got to use it a lot more than I think he ever did in the SEC.
Yeah, I don't think it's a stretch to suggest that September of this coming season could be the most critical and important and most anticipated month of the season, for all the reasons you've just touched on, and that, you know, we could get a taste of the next batch to come up and spend that month getting their feet wet at the big league level. And then 2019, like you said, is when things could really start to blossom after they get that full season, or at least close to a full season at the AAA level. So certainly some things to look forward to for the Tigers and their fans in the next year to year and a half. Jason Beck, that's a good place to wrap it up. We thank you, as always, for the time on the initial Tigers podcast of 2018, and we'll do it again at this time next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers. On this fifth day of 2018, the first Royals podcast of the new year, happy new year to all the Royals fans, and to Jeffrey Flanagan, our Royals reporter for MLB.com, who joins us right now. Jeffrey, we thank you for the time, and what we're doing this week is kind of focusing on the biggest questions that the Royals face heading into a very interesting 2018 season. But the Royals have made a little bit of noise in recent days with a reported contract offer to Eric Hosmer. We'll touch on that in a moment. But first and foremost, the Royals involved in a three-team trade along with the White Sox and the Dodgers on Thursday. And the Royals, as part of that three-team swap, they part ways with relievers Joaquin Soria and Scott Alexander, and they get a couple of highly touted prospects in return in the form of pitcher Trevor Oakes and infielder Eric Mejia. So what can you tell us about Mr. Oakes and Mr. Mejia?
Yeah, Trevor Oakes, interesting guy, sinker ball slider guy, and I think he MLB Pipeline had him rated number 14 in the Dodger system. Was kind of blocked there because of all the depth they have in the rotation, but he's certainly going to get a strong look this spring for the Royals rotation. So they need that, and that's a good pickup for them. Mejia is a kind of a guy that fits their mold. He's athletic. He's a plus runner. Plays the middle infield. Can play outfield. But Dave Moore told me last night that they would concentrate him on the infield. And you know, he might be a year or two away. But the type of prospect that they really like having, and that's all part of Dave Moore's plan right now, is to, you know, restock the farm system. He talked a lot about that at the winter meetings, and this is just one of probably many deals to come. And I thought the biggest part of last night's trade was, Thursday night's trade was, you know, being able to deal Joaquin Soria and only having to pick up $1 million, basically his buyout for 2019, out of a $10 million salary. So that cut payroll by $9 million. That's a heck of a savings for them. And certainly it hurts losing Scotty Alexander, left-hander, heavy sinker, really did a terrific job last year for them. But, you know, getting up there in age, late 20s, they needed to get younger and restock the farm system. And to do that, you've got to give away, you know, some valuable assets. So as painful it was, I thought they got a good return. And like I mentioned, they were able to save some payroll.
And, Jeffrey, that kind of takes me to the next point, and I want to get your take on this. As you were just explaining, with the parameters of the Soria trade, the team saves $9 million in payroll, and for a mid-market club like the Royals, that's not an insignificant thing. At the same time, multiple reports have come out, you know, earlier this week, that the Royals have made a reported, this is not, you know, confirmed or official, but a reported contract offer to retain Eric Hosmer, and the reported number is 7 years and $147 million. So on one hand, you've got, they're in the mode where they want to restock the farm system. They want to save money. On the other hand, they're throwing a Brinks truck or a couple of Brinks trucks at Eric Hosmer. Does this go against the grain a little bit for a team that's, you know, very openly acknowledged that they're in rebuilding mode?
Well, as we spoke in the winter meetings, the one target they've had all offseason in terms of free agents is to re-sign Eric Hosmer, and have not been able to confirm with anybody
data, and I mean anybody in the organization, that figure, that 147 million figure, is accurate. So we need to hit the brakes probably a little bit on that. I think ultimately that offer is probably lower. Maybe the years are close, but I don't think it's anywhere near 147 million. As a matter of fact, a couple officials with the Royals kind of bristled at the thought of that. And even what I've heard too has been reported in San Diego that the alleged 7-year, $140 million offer that they were supposed to give Hosmer was pretty high too. So I think the numbers are out there. They're just not quite that high. And to get there, the Royals will have to continue to shave payroll. They don't want to go over 115 or 120 million. Right now, saving $9 million on Soria, they're probably right around 106, 107. So they're getting there. If they do want to make a move with Hosmer, excuse me, and if you want to backload it, certainly possible to do that by saving, you know, $9 million here and $9 million there. It can be done. And then you get a guy who, you know, would be under contract for 7 or 8 years and would be around for the next rebuild. So there is some logic behind it.
And, Jeffrey, too, knowing Eric Hosmer as you do, having covered him for, you know, all 7 years of his big league career, is he the type of guy that, you know, if he's faced with a prospect of returning to a Kansas City club, which is in this transitional period, would that appeal to him, you know, for a guy that's reached the highest of highs as a World Series champion, having won an additional pennant to all the individual accolades? Would it be in his personality or against it, you know, to come back to a club that, you know, clearly for a couple of years is not going to be amongst baseball's elite?
Yeah, Haas and I talked about that a little bit at the end of last year, and I think it does appeal to him. I mean, he loves Kansas City, loves the community, loves the Royals organization, loves that locker room. He would be a leader in that locker room, a mentor for some of the younger guys as they come forward. You know, he's talked a lot about the mentors he's had when he came up through the system, and I think it is appealing to him to possibly be that guy. That's why he's listening to offers from San Diego and Kansas City. And ultimately, though, he's got to do what's best for him and his family. And you know, if that is the Yankees or the Cardinals or some mystery team that always seems to pop up in these things in the late going, Seattle, whatever, he would have to go there. But I think the Royals, what they offer is familiarity, and I think that would mean a lot to him, and I don't think he'd have any problem coming back here.
Yeah, very interesting. It's the saga continues through the next couple of weeks, I would speculate, because the hot stove has been rather slow the last month and a half. So this could drag out, you know, close to when spring training opens their doors, and we'll see what the future holds for Eric Hosmer, and maybe, just maybe, he has not played his final game as a Kansas City Royal. Time will tell. So, Jeffrey, backtracking a little bit, we talked about, you know, the trade, shipping away the veteran Joaquin Soria, the youngster Scott Alexander. When you look at other players on this team that are, you know, trade assets or trade possibilities, who would you earmark as guys that Dayton Moore may be looking to ship away to further restock that farm system?
Well, there's some of the obvious names that really came up a lot during the winter meetings. They got a lot of hits on guys like Danny Duffy and Kelvin Herrera. You know, Whit Merrifield is another guy who emerged last year, you know, 19 home runs, and they get 34 steals, hit almost 290. You know, he's 28 years old, but has proven that, you know, he can be a leadoff guy and play quality defense at second base. Danny Duffy's a guy who's under club control for several more years. Herrera's definitely another guy right now who could be a late inning guy for somebody else. The only question there, of course, he only has 1 year of club control left, so you're not going to get a huge return, but still can, you know, brings it high 90s fastball, terrific sinker. You know, just look around that ball club, just about anybody. They'd certainly like to be able to move Jason Hamill too. I should mention him. And he comes with $11 million guaranteed on his deal, so that's going to be a little bit tougher, but anybody who's of value, Dayton Moore has made it clear, could be traded. They just have to restock that farm system right now and go toward a rebuild, which will take maybe 2, maybe 3 years. So that's their entire focus this offseason.
And, of course, you know, Dayton's made no bones about it that the priority number one is to restock that farm system, and they've already made some strides in that regard. So given the fact that that is priority, is there, you know, a consensus that anybody on the team is a potential trade possibility, or is there at least one, maybe two players that may be considered untouchable or close to it?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the one guy that they would really, really be hesitant to deal is Salvador Perez. They're often our gold glove catcher. I brought that question up to Dayton at the winter meetings, and then we talked about it a little bit last week, too. I don't think they feel, number one, that they'd ever get enough in return for him. And number two, going through this rebuild, it's going to be painful enough for Royals fans to, say goodbye to Moustakas and to Lorenzo Cain and, possibly Eric Hosmer and Elcides Escobar and Jason Vargas. You just go down the list. They already lost Mike Minor. And just to lose someone like Salvador Perez, who's on billboards all over Kansas City, that might be just too much, I think, in the Royals' minds to be able to have to part with him, too. So, and he'd be a good mentor for a youth movement, too, just like Eric Hosmer would. As a matter of fact, those two guys locker next to each other. And I've often told fans that I think Dayton Moore, in his heart of hearts, really wants to keep those two lockered next to each other again next year if he can do it with any possibility. So, yeah, that's the one guy that's probably untouchable. But anybody else, some of these contracts are going to be really, really difficult to move. You're not going to be able to move Alex Gordon's contract or Ian Kennedy's, but I think the one guy that's really untouchable is probably Sal.
And assuming that Eric Hosmer does not return and that he takes his talents somewhere else, do you see, maybe this term gets overblown a little bit, it becomes a little cliched, but would you earmark Perez as the face of the franchise? Would it be Alex Gordon? Like, who do you see as like the main marquee guy for the Royals if Hosmer does depart?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it would if Eric Hosmer does go elsewhere, it would have to be Salvador Perez. But I really think, in the front office mind, it's still, even though he's a free agent, Eric Hosmer is still the face of this franchise. That's why they're trying so hard to come up with a deal that will keep him in Kansas City. He has meant so much to this community and so much to the organization that I don't think they can picture a Kansas City Royals team without Eric Hosmer. So, business is business. So if he goes on somewhere else, it'll have to be Salvador Perez. I don't think Alex Gordon is coming off of two really poor years. I don't think, even though he probably was the face of the franchise for a while, I don't think he's necessarily that guy anymore. And they're, of course, hoping he'll bounce back. But it would probably have to they'd have to hand that over to Salvador Perez.
Yeah, I mean, as badly as they want to get Hosmer back, and why wouldn't they? Sal Perez is not a bad consolation prize.
Right.
He's a great guy, great clubhouse presence, and obviously great on the field and behind the plate. And that, like I said, that is not a bad plan B whatsoever. Jeffrey, to wrap this up, and you kind of touched on this already briefly, but in terms of the duration of this rebuild, some take longer than others. Some are dictated by the competition within your own division. So considering all those factors, what kind of a timetable do you see for the Royals, developing these young assets and getting back to prominence?
Yeah, I would think, Dayton's talked about 2020 or 2021. I think it's going to be at least that long. We're talking about the 2018 this year. You've got guys like Jorge Bonifacio, Chester Cuthbert, Jacob Junis in the rotation, some of the younger guys in the bullpen. If those guys develop quickly, and Alex Gordon has a bounce back year or something like that, maybe 2020 they could be competitive again. The next pipeline of guys is really, to be honest, 2 or 3 years away. So it kind of depends on how these guys that are already on the roster right now, how they can develop. How quickly can they develop? And then you start to sprinkle in, some of the other guys. And to be honest, between, you and me, I think it's going to be 2021 at the earliest.
And, of course, Royals fans have been through this process before,
yes,
having, these young assets and watching them develop and go through their growing pains. And the payoff was great. Two pennants and a world title, and maybe the Royals get back there before long. But again, the road can be long, and we'll see what happens as time progresses. Our time is up. Jeffrey Flanagan, we thank you so much for it, and we'll do it again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals. It is the first Twins podcast of the brand new year 2018, but certainly not the last. A happy new year to all the Twins fans out there, and to you, Rhett Bollinger as well as Rhett, our Twins reporter, joining us here today to talk all things Twins baseball heading into 2018. And let's think warm thoughts on these very cold winter days all across the country as we gear up for 2018. We'll kind of run down the five biggest questions facing Minnesota as they want to get back to the playoffs in back-to-back years. So, Rhett, I think a good place to start. This has always been the topic du jour whenever we talk Twins baseball, their pursuit of a frontline starter. What kind of odds do you put on the Twins getting that elite guy, whether it's you, Darvish, or perhaps somebody else on that next tier? How do you think the Twins' chances are right now?
I think the odds are still pretty good here. I do think the Twins are going to try to get a top-line starter. Whether it's going to be Darvish is hard to say. At this point, it kind of is hard to even guess where Darvish is going to go. You know, he's met with some teams already, teams like the Cubs, his former team, the Rangers, the Astros as well. I'm sure the Dodgers will probably be in that mix as well, too, coming off that team. So it's hard to say what will happen with Darvish, but even if they strike out on Darvish, I think they've got a good chance to go after a guy like, Lance Lynn or Alex Cobb. I mean, Jake Arrieta as well. I think they just have more interest in a guy like Cobb or Lynn more than they have a guy like Arrieta right now. Arrieta might just be a little bit too costly if they're looking for in terms of the age, too. He's a little bit older than those two guys. They want some younger guys that can be a little bit more affordable. I mean, I think the Cobb and Lynn are both going to get pretty good contracts, but the fact that they're both tied to the compensation for draft pick might bring down their value a little bit. So I do think they'll find somebody, and obviously they can go the trade route as well. But I do think no matter what, they need a starter to go into that, rotation. Right now the rotation, they like the top of it with Ervin Santana and Jose Berríos. After that, though, they don't have as much depth they used to. Kyle Gibson had a nice second half. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of young guys. Alberto Mejia's in that mix. Prospects like, Fernando Romero and Cesar Gonçalves. And you've got guys coming off injuries like, Phil Hughes and Trevor May. So there's a lot of question marks beyond those top two guys and maybe Gibson. So I do think they need to get some sort of top-line guy that's going to fit up there, toward the top of that rotation with Santana and Berríos. I do think it will happen. It's just hard to say who at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to have Santana and Berríos as your one and two, but if you can have them as your two and three and put a bona fide ace at the top at that number one spot, obviously that only makes things better for the Twins and for that rotation as a whole, one through five. Rhett, interesting question you posed here. With so many young guys on this team coming into their own and forming what is hopefully the nucleus of this Twins team for years to come, what players would you say right now amongst that younger group are the biggest priorities in terms of contract extensions?
Well, it's definitely going to be a priority for the team. I asked Thad Levine, the GM, about that at the winter meeting. It's just kind of get a feel for how far in the process they are in terms of identifying players they want to extend, if they had any talks with the agents about that. They have not at this point yet. I think their plan is when spring training starts and the roster is finalized, and they know their budget, they'll kind of have more of a feel for how they want to approach that and talk to different agents for these guys. You got to figure Buxton's got to be the number one priority. Buxton's, the future star of this team, a great guy to build around, all-around player, but also just a good person in the community, a good face in the franchise. So you got to figure they really want to extend him. It's just a matter of if he wants to go year to year. That's the whole thing with this whole thing. There's this whole, extension thing is these guys don't have to sign an extension if they don't want to. They can continue to go year to year with arbitration hits and get paid that way and then become free agency, become a free agent earlier. Obviously, the benefit of signing an extension is you get that guaranteed money up front and you might buy out a year or two of your free agency and become a free agent a couple years later. Miguel Sano, I'm sure they'll have contact with him as well. Max Kepler, maybe even Jorge Polanco. A lot of these young guys, they want to lock up for a while. I mean, I think the middle infield is a little bit tough because with Polanco, just because, you got Nick Gordon coming up. You don't know really the situation yet with Brian Dozier. But same thing with Dozier and Mauer, even though they're not young guys. They're both going to the last year of their contracts. The Twins could look to keep one or both of those guys as well, too. I mean, both faces of the franchise. Mauer's only played with the Twins. Has been the face of the franchise now for a decade, more than a decade. Could he come back on a smaller deal to stay with the organization after next year? We'll find out more as the season goes along. Same with Dozier, big-time player for this team with the power and same thing as a clubhouse leader and also a face of this franchise. Will he be extended or are they going to let him walk and decide to go with a younger middle infield with Polanco and maybe Nick Gordon? So there's just a lot to kind of look forward to and see with the young core of guys, but also with some of these veterans in the last year. So I think extension talk is something we'll definitely be monitoring a lot in spring training and even throughout the season to see what they want to do with these young players and the veterans with their contracts.
Yeah, obviously you talked about Joe Mauer on the other end of that spectrum. He is right now obviously the face of the franchise, but a guy that could inherit that mantle one day and maybe one day soon is Byron Buxton. And when you look at his talent, he had a breakthrough 2017, and he could truly be one of the elite players in the game. Do you see him maybe one day joining that class of the Mike Trouts and the Altuves, Machados and Bryce Harpers? Do you see him in that class or maybe a tier or two below that?
I think the sky's the limit. I think that's certainly possible. I mean, you got to see if the offense is really going to get to that point. It was in the second half of this year, that breakout. If he continues that kind of breakout the way that he did with the power and speed that he had, then yeah, you got to put him in that kind of class because he does so much defensively. And he's the best defensive player in baseball. We pretty much know that now with all the defensive metrics out there and even just the awards he got from the Platinum Gold Glove to the Wilson Defensive Player of the Year. He's the best defensive player in the majors. And when he can add, all-star type offense to that, all of a sudden now you're talking about one of the elite players in the game. So, but the jury's still out though if he's going to reach that level of offense just because it was such a small sample size. It really only was, I guess it started maybe in, late May, June-ish. But really it was July, August, September that he really dominated. I think he's got to do it for a longer stretch to prove that. But it's a great sign because that was kind of the worry they've had the last couple of years was he dominated the minor leagues offensively, but really struggled his first couple of years in the majors. But that's not, too untypical for a guy his age. He's only 24 years old now going into this season. He was 23 last year. So he's still a young guy in his, early to mid-20s. They can continue to get better. So I do think he can reach that class. I think that was always kind of the hope all along. He was the game's number one prospect for, 3 out of 4 years for MLB.com. So he always had that kind of trajectory. It just kind of got stalled a little bit with some of those issues in the majors early on with his plate discipline and his pitch recognition. But I think that now he's gotten a better feel for that. He's fixed his mechanics. I do think that an MVP type, season or player is something that Buxton can become. But it's still, like I said, it's still too early until he really does it again for a full season. It really shows the offense is legit. But if it is, with his defensive speed, he is definitely the real deal.
And there's a school of thought that sometimes the best thing a young player can do is struggle. And Byron Buxton had those struggles, by leaps and bounds. There's no question there. But, he's had them. He's learned from them. He's hopefully put it behind him. And now he can take that next step to being not just a good player or very good, but a great to elite player. And maybe 2018 is the season that whole thing happens over the course of a full campaign. Rhett, let's transition to the bullpen. Even after signing the veteran closer, Fernando Rodney, and his magical bow and arrow, how much of a concern is the rest of that bullpen right now?
It's not too much of a concern right now because they just signed Zach Duke as well. He is coming off Tommy John surgery that he returned from in July with the Cardinals. But Duke kind of gives him a veteran lefty in there, and then Rodney can be that closer at the back end. Because they still have some intriguing young arms that they really like, Trevor Hildenberger to be their main setup reliever. Taylor Rogers has put together two really nice seasons in a row there. They're hoping that Ryan Pressly and Tyler Duffy can bounce back a little bit. You never know if Trevor May or Phil Hughes might go into the bullpen as well. And they've got other young arms they like a lot. They're in the minor leagues and guys like Gabriel Moya, Jake Reed. There's some guys that are on the upswing here, John Curtis. There's some young arms that are really starting to fill up this bullpen. So it's not as much of a concern right now. I think they wanted to sign probably two relievers. They went for Rodney and Duke, which are both pretty low cost. Rodney got the 1 year and an option, and Duke only got the 1 year. Both guys, are getting up there in age a little bit. So not long-term signings. But I think they kind of want to have that flexibility because they feel like they have some young guys that can maybe step up and be the closer after this season. But for now, at least, they have some veterans in the back end. They could obviously add another guy here. But more likely, if I had to guess, it'd probably be like a minor league free agent type. But they really haven't spent too much money in the bullpen, which I guess maybe allows them to have a bigger budget to try to sign a guy like Darvish, or Lynn or Cobb. I think they certainly have the money to do that if that were to be the case, especially because so far, as much as they've fixed the bullpen a little bit, it hasn't really been a costly endeavor. They've been kind of two low-cost veterans to kind of fill out that bullpen.
And Rhett, to wrap things up here, sometimes the biggest obstacle that a team faces after coming out of nowhere to succeed and coming out of nowhere to reach the playoffs, as the Twins did in 2017, is now in the ensuing season, you have that weight of expectation, which, of course, when you lose 100 plus games, there are zero expectations. The Twins have that now. Would you earmark that as their biggest obstacle, their biggest challenge in getting back to the postseason?
I would think so, yes. I mean, even if you look at 2 years ago, they're coming off that season after Mauer's first year as manager. The Twins, surprisingly made it to the third to last day, second to last day of the season before they're eliminated from the postseason that year. I think that everyone thought that, you know, two seasons ago was maybe going to be a year the Twins would continue to build on their kind of surprise season. Next year had some expectations. I remember the, you know, opening day, Terry Ryan saying that, you know, this is a playoff caliber ball club. And then sure enough, we know that's a team that ended up losing 103 games and was the worst team in baseball. So sometimes expectations definitely can go awry just having that feeling now that they're supposed to win. But I think this team's better equipped to continue to get better, because I do like that young core a lot. I think Buxton continually is getting better offensively. You know, if they can stay healthy offensively, they've got a great young core. They don't have to really change much with that. The pitching is going to be the big key. We've talked about it a million times, but they still got to add a starter to contend. But at least they've got some young arms. Like I said, they're in the bullpen, and they've got Barrios and Santana atop the rotation. So, but it's going to be tough because I think a lot of the big clubs so far continue to get better. We've, you know, the Yankees, to kind of what they've done this offseason, even the Angels have added a lot too. And those are two teams that were, you know, the wild card type teams. So we're not even talking about the teams that won their divisions last year. So that's kind of the way it shapes up in baseball right now. It seems like there's a lot of super teams, and then there's the teams that are rebuilding, and there's the teams that are kind of in the tiers between it. And I think the Twins are probably just in that tier, obviously, below the super teams. So it's going to be a little tough for them to break in other than being the wild card, unless the Indians really fall off here. So it's going to be a lot for them to make the playoffs back-to-back years. But they have that young core. If they can continue to develop and they can add a starting pitcher this offseason, it can happen. But you're definitely right. The expectations are there now, and they're going to be there continually. I think at this point, the fact that they made it already, it might have been earlier than people expected. People think this team should be good going forward. And if they're not, it's going to fall on the front office, and it's going to fall on Mulder. So there is definitely some pressure now to win. And I think that that's going to kind of manifest itself in the way they build this ball club, even next year in free agency, and they continue to add more and more pitching and more pieces to make this a consistent winner going forward.
Yeah, that's always a big step in any team's development when you can't sneak up on anybody like the Twins did in 2017. Teams are going to know what this Twin squad is all about, having reached the postseason, having reached the wild card game. So that's always a next big developmental step to see if the Twins can handle that and take that next step forward. And I think we all agree that the Central belongs to the Indians for the foreseeable future, but there's no reason why the Twins can't make some noise, especially if they get that coveted number one starter, whether it's Yu Darvish or someone else, to take us full circle. And that's a good place to wrap this one up on this Friday, the 5th of January. Rhett Bollinger, great stuff as always. We appreciate the time, and we'll do it again soon. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins.